Welcome to Health Law Expressions Podcast, the who, what, when, and why of information sharing. I'm Barbara Blackman, and I'm here with my colleague Ian Donaldson. We teach the Complete Course for Medical Staff Leaders, and this is a topic that we cover at the Complete Course in several places. We are going to start today with the why. Why share information? That's the most important question to ask. And we suggest that patient safety is the most important reason to share information. Information sharing should be driven by what is best for patients. Information sharing can also help reduce the risk of liability for negligent credentialing. Information sharing can help promote efficiency and eliminate redundant efforts, and promote consistency among the entities in a system or within a hospital. So now that we know why, Ian, who might share information?
It really depends on how you're organized. If you're a multi-hospital system, we could be talking about related hospital-to-hospital type sharing situations. If you're structured such that you have a separate medical group, for example, that employs your physicians and other practitioners, there could be sharing with that organization at certain points in time. Joint ventures where the hospital is a majority owner. We've really seen this set up in any number of ways, and sometimes it even includes non-affiliated physician groups. Maybe you have a large independent multi-specialty group in your community, and we've seen information sharing agreements that anticipate sharing with those bodies if they have, for example, their own peer review process and some sort of agreement or arrangement with the system or an individual hospital. So the who really does vary. A lot of that is going to be somewhat dependent on some of the legal protection issues that we're going to talk about later. But once you've identified who you're sharing with, it's important to start thinking about when you're going to share.
So when can we share information? We can share information at initial appointment. We know that we need some information to process an application for initial appointment and privileges. Regulatory and accreditation standards require evidence of current competence and verification from primary sources of information that we use in credentialing and privileging. Once someone has been appointed to the medical staff and granted privileges, we also can share information at reappointment. Reappointment must be based upon performance, and hospitals do ongoing professional practice evaluation, and some of the other entities we're talking about also do some kind of review. So beyond initial appointment and reappointment, we can also share information when a specified step occurs. In a few minutes, we'll talk about how you can build that into your documents. But in many situations, we see information sharing policies or agreements provide for information sharing when there is a performance improvement plan involving an individual practitioner, whenever there is focused professional practice evaluation that's initiated after someone is on the staff, whenever a review has been triggered by an indicator and the professional practice evaluation or peer review committee has determined to initiate an FPPE. We can share information when a formal investigation has been initiated, and we can share information when an adverse action has been recommended. More and more we are seeing organizations, that's hospitals and systems, develop these information sharing policies and procedures when these steps occur. And that can happen automatically or it can happen upon request. Whenever we see information that is flagged by a National Practitioner Data Bank report, that almost always triggers some kind of information sharing process. The National Practitioner Data Bank was intended by Congress to be a flagging mechanism to prompt additional questions from the entity that does the query to the entity that made the report. So that is intended to prompt those inquiries, and that generally leads to sharing of information from one organization to the other. Now, we've been talking about the why, the who, and the when, but what information are we talking about, Ian?
That's another one where it's going to be an organizational decision. I think we've probably both written policies like this that have varied from anywhere to sharing, you know, all OPP, FPP, and other peer review data to simply giving name, rank, and serial number type information or good standing letters. So when we draft these policies, it's really going to be an important step for you to define what you're going to share, not only when you're going to share it and with who, but again, giving some definition to what that information is going to look like, calling it confidential information or whatever your sort of defined term is, and then thinking about, okay, when we use this term, do we mean all correspondence to and from a practitioner? Do we mean external reviews of that individual's clinical practice? Are we talking about the analysis and findings of our peer review process? Summaries of peer references? It's really going to be up to you all to decide, what do we mean when we're talking about information within that scope of that type of sharing arrangement or policy? And articulating that out in the policy, I think, is a good best practice so that there's no uncertainty around that. You'd also want to include some guardrails about what you don't want to share, if that's the case as well. I'm thinking of, you know, so often we're talking about comparative data where you may have more than one physician or practitioner's information on a report. And so you probably don't want to share that for the other three or four physicians within a specialty if the sharing solely relates to Dr. A, for example. So again, just helping yourselves anticipate some of those kind of issues on the front end through good guidance on your policy makes a lot of sense.
So the question on everyone's mind must be by now, what about legal protection for information sharing? Most states have a law that protects peer review. Typically, those laws start with peer review conducted by hospital medical staff committees. The purpose of those laws is to promote candor in the peer review process so that physicians will be comfortable discussing quality in the context of a confidential setting that won't show up in a medical malpractice lawsuit later. So, states have in some cases been expanding that protection beyond hospital medical staff committees to other entities. But state laws vary widely, so you should always work with counsel when you're talking about developing information sharing policies or some of the other documents that we'll talk about in a minute. The definitions vary. Some states, either in the statutes or in court decisions, have differentiated between peer review and credentials files. And so in a few states, a document that is a credentials file might not be protected in its entirety, although some elements of that file might be protected. And again, you're going to want to work with your counsel and track the language in your state's peer review law. Most of these laws are designed to protect peer review information from discovery in medical malpractice cases, and that may be the greatest fear that physicians have. But what some don't realize is that information that may be protected from discovery in a state medical malpractice case might still be discoverable in certain federal cases like employment discrimination or antitrust cases. So we want to be careful that we work with counsel to manage those situations. Now, confidentiality is absolutely critical. Ian, can this privilege ever be waived?
Well, it is possible, and it's certainly a fear that we talk about probably from the podium, and we know your in-house counsel and others in leadership are always drilling in folks' head the idea that we don't want to be in a spot where we waive the legal protections that we have around that protected information. And so it does come down to confidentiality and maintaining that. The good thing is, this was a number of years ago now, a couple of our partners did a law review article where they did a deep dive into the waiver cases related to peer review. And fortunately, it doesn't happen as often as you'd think. It's one of those ones where I think the fear of waiver is probably a little larger than the actual number of cases where a waiver has been found. But we still obviously want to be careful with that and not find ourselves in the next HLE headline related to a waiver situation. So how do we do that? Well, just like Barbara talked about, right? We want to make sure that we're tracking to the extent that we can our state peer review protections as we develop any sort of policy around information sharing. I think the reality is a lot of those aren't going to talk too much about sharing. I think about our home state. I don't know if that peer review statute's been touched in 30 or 40 years. So it just doesn't anticipate some of the modern structures that we have. So that's where you want to have some self-serving language in your policy, language that talks about how you have no intention of waiving any related protections that you have when you do this type of sharing, that your policy is really meant to be a way to enhance the peer review work that you're doing, always bringing it back to language that talks about how you're doing it for patient safety. We think that's really some of the best protections that you have if you're ever facing a challenge that you can point to your policy and show that, no, this sharing wasn't something that we just did willy-nilly. It was really done through a deliberate, well-thought-out process.
So that brings us to what documents you need. We've mentioned information sharing policies or agreements between entities in a system. Your framework really, though, should begin with your bylaws or your credentials policy. More commonly, we see information sharing authorization language in a credentials policy so that every applicant for appointment and reappointment understands that information will be shared within the entities within a system and also in response to external credentialing inquiries. And we also recommend that that same language be added to all of your application forms, an authorization and a release. Now, you might need a special release for specific situations, such as when an applicant has had issues at a prior hospital and that hospital doesn't want to provide that information, absent some extra protection, so the applicant can be asked to sign a special release allowing that information to be provided before the application is deemed complete for processing. Now, we mentioned a policy or an agreement among entities. Sometimes it's a system board resolution, and the system board adopts a resolution authorizing the information to be shared within the entities within a system. If your hospital utilizes a central credentials verification office or organization, or if your medical staff office serves as a CVO for other entities within your system, there should be some language in any CVO contracts that outlines the information sharing process and policies. And finally, it's a good idea to have peer review confidentiality agreements signed by all who have access to confidential peer review information. What else can we do to maximize protection, Ian?
Well, we've seen some creative thinking, back to the example I gave earlier about where perhaps you have an unaffiliated group or an entity like that that you've engaged in some sort of formalized sharing arrangement for. Some places have taken a belts and suspenders approach of not only having that arrangement or agreement in place, but also perhaps taking the CMO of that group or a medical director of that group and hardwiring that position into certain key medical staff committees related to peer reviews. So, for example, if they had a multi-specialty peer review committee, that medical director of that affiliate or other group in the community may have a seat at the table at that committee. That does a couple of things. One, again, they're now there by the bylaws. There's no argument that they were in attendance when they shouldn't have been. And conversely, there's no argument to be had that they were given information that they didn't have a need to know, because again, they're hardwired in as a committee member to that body. So those are some of the things that we've seen. Again, I think there's a lot of room for creative thinking here beyond just the documents and thinking about some of the way you structure your committees and whatnot to accomplish that sort of sharing in a safe manner.
And finally, if you ever do find yourselves in a situation where discovery of sensitive peer review information has been ordered, make sure that your counsel fights hard to get a protective order so it never sees the light of day. So there are risks. We think it's important to manage them because we think the benefits outweigh the risks.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think we're seeing sort of a change in thought. I want to say 5 to 7 years ago, we would float this idea working with various systems. And I think by and large, I felt we got the most pushback from in-house counsel that was, you know, very sort of conservative in their approach to not wanting to waive any sort of legal protection, which we understood on our side. But I think over time, as folks sort of understand the ways in which you can structure these in a, what we feel is a relatively safe manner, we're seeing a lot more buy-in to that concept. But again, it's just as Barb said, it's about identifying the risk and then managing them appropriately.
Thanks, and join us at the complete course if you can, because we'll talk about this in a little more depth.